Around the World with Reporters.
The UK government is mulling over plans to put some travellers coming to England in so-called quarantine hotels amid concerns about new variants of the virus.
As we vaccinate more people, it becomes more and more important that we protect against any new variants coming in. Once you have that protection and you don't have new variants in the country, you should protect against them.
Despite the high death toll, case numbers in the UK are slowly falling thanks to the lockdown. But the government is facing mounting pressure over when the restrictions, among them school closures, will be eased. As for the rest of Europe, well, they're worried about an outbreak of the so-called British variant within their borders.
Different European countries have different measures in place, lockdowns, curfews, but with their healthcare systems under immense pressure, they may have to enforce even stricter measures soon.
But the restrictions of freedoms already in place are testing people's patience. In the Netherlands, at least 150 people arrested Monday during unrest and looting in towns and cities across the country over an 8 p.m. curfew.
Het heeft ook niks te maken wat we zagen met strijden voor de vrijheid. We nemen al deze maatregelen.
What we saw has nothing to do with fighting for freedom. We didn't take all these measures for fun. We did so because we are fighting against the virus, and it's the virus which is actually robbing our freedom.
While the UK heads towards its mid-February target of 15 million vaccinations, across the EU, growing frustration with the pace of immunization. Last week, AstraZeneca told the EU it was falling behind on its supply target because of production problems. The EU Commission, in charge of approving and procuring the jabs, isn't happy.
This new schedule is not acceptable to the European Union. The European Union has pre-financed the development of the vaccine and its production and wants to see the return.
The delays will make it harder for the EU to meet its plan to vaccinate 70% of its adult population by late summer, leading to a deepening of the crisis across the bloc. The UK and European Union have survived Brexit and the financial lockdown of 2008. But it remains to be seen if they will survive COVID-19. Saeed Pariza, London.
Iranian Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif made a stop in Moscow for talks with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov on mutual and international issues. In a joint press conference, Zarif said Iran will take proper action whenever the United States lifts the sanctions to pave the way for its return to the 2015 nuclear deal.
What we have heard from the United States administration so far has mostly been in the form of words and announcements of its position. However, it is actions that we respond to.
For his part, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Moscow and Iran share the same position on how to preserve the historic deal, adding that it was up to the United States to take the first steps by removing the sanctions.
Both we and Iran are deeply interested in a full return of signatory states to fulfilling their obligations under the accord.
The top Iranian diplomat said Trump's departure brought along special circumstances that required Tehran and Moscow to coordinate their positions in this regard.
Our focus today was on the Caucasus and the regional efforts for bringing peace and stability in the Caucasus, because I am right now engaged in a regional trip to countries in the Caucasus, plus Russia and Turkey. We also had a major discussion about global situation and how we can revive the nuclear deal.
With the election of Joseph Biden, hopes for a more balanced approach from Washington and a return to the nuclear deal have been revived.
If this happens, and we hope that we'll be able to achieve such a result, then of course the relations between Iran and the Russian Federation will benefit, since they will be removed from illegitimate, illegal unilateral sanctions, both from the United States and from a number of other countries.
Zarif arrived in Moscow after paying a visit to Azerbaijan, where he sat down with Azeri President Ilham Aliyev.
Iran and Russia said they are determined to expand mutual ties and continue cooperation in regional stability and international security. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Italy's Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte tendered his resignation, throwing Italy into a government crisis in the midst of a pandemic that has devastated the country. More than 85,000 lives have been lost to coronavirus as Italy's economy is falling deeper into chaos. After surviving two confidence votes last week, Conte has reportedly decided to quit because his executive risked being defeated in a vote over a contested report on the justice system in the Senate, where he no longer has an absolute majority.
President of the Republic Sergio Mattarella received this morning the President of the Council of Ministers Giuseppe Conte, who handed in the resignation of the government that he presides. The President of the Republic has decided to invite the government to remain in charge to handle the current affairs.
The government was plunged into crisis after former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi pulled his junior partner Italia Viva out of the ruling coalition on January 13. Renzi had withdrawn his support over issues including differences on the COVID-19 recovery plan and the handling of the coronavirus outbreak. Conte is now expected to seek a third mandate from the President of the Republic, Sergio Mattarella, to form a new executive with a broader coalition. Should he fail to do so, Mattarella may decide to bring in a new prime minister or call for snap elections.
La risposta è molto semplice.
I'm going to make this very simple. This political crisis will result in more interest to be paid by Rome on its public debt due to an increase of the spread between Italy and Germany's 10-year yields. Whoever becomes prime minister next will have to implement tough reforms, including slashing health and social spending, in order to access the resources allocated in the EU's recovery fund.
On Wednesday, Italy's head of state, Mattarella, is slated to start a round of formal consultations with party leaders and other institutional figures to see whether a new coalition can be formed.
It isn't certain where this political crisis will lead. What is certain is that not even the world's worst pandemic in a century has persuaded the Italian politicians to remain united to face an unprecedented health crisis together. After the collapse of 66 governments in just 75 years of democracy, the country's future is now in the hands of President Mattarella. Max Civili, Rome.
Streets were deserted, shops were closed, and businesses were abandoned in Indian-controlled Kashmir as India celebrated its 72nd Republic Day.
What is there for the people of Kashmir to celebrate? Our special status was stripped, and so were our rights. The promises that were made were just a show-off. Our jobs, our land, and our opportunities are on sale. So what should I celebrate?
Amid suspended internet services and heightened security arrangements, authorities have held a symbolic Republic Day parade in a highly secured sports stadium in the heart of Srinagar. Indian-controlled Kashmir came under India's absolute control after New Delhi stripped Kashmir of its special status in August 2019. Following the move, pro-freedom groups in the disputed region were detained so that any dissent against India's decision would be prevented.
The democratic values for which the India is advocating and India is calling in the world that it is the biggest democracy, they are not following it actually on ground. Democracy gives the right of dissent.
Although New Delhi says the revocation of Article 370 was to integrate Jammu and Kashmir into the rest of India for easier development and equal opportunity for the citizens, analysts say the reality on the ground is quite the opposite.
But after revocation of Article 370, which was one of the articles of the Constitution of India, the government's attitude has been more aggressive and arrogant, not people-friendly. There is no democracy on ground. The democratic setup has been closed down and an authoritative setup has been put in, which is working with a dictatorial attitude. And the people are suffering.
By staying indoors on India's Republic Day, people of Kashmir have once again displayed their level of alienation. Analysts say India needs to take necessary steps and fulfill its promises in order to win their hearts. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
The cities are the most important human habitat in the modern era. They show the extent of civilization, social life, and the blossoming of the capabilities of the citizens. Today, that geographical boundaries do not exist thanks to the modern communication technologies, better urban management techniques can be identified through sharing global experiences. The municipality of Tehran has been a pioneer in hosting international events since 2014 and has brought together academic and executive elites in the field of urban management from all over the world to provide a forum for exchanging urban experiences. The fifth edition of the Tehran Golden Adobe Global Award was held at a time that the whole world is hit by the spread of the coronavirus.
Amid the corona pandemic, we were in touch with the mayors of many major cities of the world to share experiences. We informed them about the tough situation of Iran, where it is hit by the cruel sanctions on the one hand and the corona problems on the other hand. We used urban symbols like Azadi Square to sympathize with those struggling with the pandemic. Via video mapping, we were the first city to sympathize with those hit by the virus in China's Wuhan.
Some distinguished foreign guests who were present at the closing ceremony of Tehran Golden Adobe Award also touched upon the role of urban management at critical times.
We have to think that COVID has imposed new expectations but also new realities, and we have to look at capacities for a new digital age. And finally, it's not only about capacities, it's also about the agency, the institutions. So we have to look at how government and institutions operate in this context and how we can look at more healthier, greener, and equitable policies.
At the end of the ceremony, Tehran's Global Award for Urban Management in different categories was handed to the best project in the cities, regions, and local communities worldwide. Tehran Golden Adobe Award is a comprehensive academic non-profit initiative that specializes in international urban management research and exchange. However, due to the spread of the coronavirus, this edition focused on methods used by urban managers to cope with the pandemic. Human Abadi, Tehran.
In yet another effort to stop Saudi Arabia's devastating war on Yemen, this time 24 British Parliament members have urged Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab to halt the country's arms sales to Riyadh. In a letter, they have underlined that up to £15 billion worth of UK-made arms have been sold to the Saudi regime since it launched a war on Yemen in 2015. The letter also cites a recent UN report on the situation in Yemen, adding that the war has already claimed 233,000 lives, while about 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian assistance. Many political experts believe that the Saudi-led war is being perceived globally as unwarranted and genocidal.
The global perception now about the Yemen war, if nothing else, is that this was unwarranted and genocidal. I mean, there's no justification for it. And it was a Saudi assault, but orchestrated by UK and US military personnel. Officers were in the Saudi capital from the very beginning, and of course all the weaponry that the Saudi military uses in this genocidal assault is US and UK military hardware.
Since 2015, the Saudi-led bombing and blockade of Yemen have devastated much of the poor country's infrastructure, with the UN calling it the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Half of Yemen's population is now on the brink of famine, many of them children. The country has also experienced the world's worst cholera outbreak and now struggling with an alarming COVID-related death rate. From the onset of war, many international rights groups and activists have slammed the West in general and the United States, Britain, France, and Canada in particular for their support for the Saudi-led coalition. They have repeatedly called on these governments to suspend weapon sales to Riyadh and Abu Dhabi to avoid a humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen. In September, a UN experts group named Canada for the first time as the one perpetuating the conflict in Yemen by selling arms to Saudi Arabia. So far, international calls have fallen on deaf ears as not only Saudi Arabia continues with its bombing campaign and blockade of Yemen, but its Western backers too continue supplying the regime with lethal weapons. It seems that what matters to Western powers most is putting their profit out of arms exports to their repressive Arab regimes above human rights and the lives of millions of impoverished Yemenis.
The Democrat-led lower house of Congress has forced a second impeachment trial in the Senate for ex-President Donald Trump on charges of incitement of insurrection following the deadly protests inside Capitol Hill on January 6th. There is seemingly no chance that a supermajority two-thirds of the Senate, which is evenly split between both parties, will vote to convict Trump this time either. Recent polls show America is almost evenly split on if Trump deserves a conviction, meaning the trial will be yet another highly divisive political event.
I think Democrats are basically taking this opportunity to once and for all kind of like rally around that, like, this person is, like, you know, evil. He's bad for the system. This is a terrible president to send. They're really just trying to hammer down that you can't get away with this stuff. This, and the president in his own words really did, like, rile up these people to come to the Capitol and, you know, wreak havoc. It's more of, I think, what they're going towards is, like, you can't come here and touch us.
Analysts suggest that Democrats may be pushing the trial as a way to weaken the Republican Party by forcing Republicans to openly choose between pro-Trump and anti-Trump factions. Conservatives could be weakened by infighting for years. Trump remains incredibly popular among Republicans, but a conviction would forbid him from holding office and running for president in 2024. Given the record anger, disunity, and polarization, many wonder if a successful conviction could backfire and provoke even greater problems.
All it really does is creates a vacuum for another figurehead to kind of go in there and take control of this mob of quite literally fascist. This is like fascism in actual definition. And what this does is, you know, we know Trump is a con man. We know Trump was often like bumbling his way through things. He was kind of like, you know, a joke, a mockery of the system. This unfortunately creates a vacuum where someone more competent in terms of just, you know, oppression, repression, can take control of this vacuum that Trump is leaving behind.
New President Joe Biden is being criticized for allowing Congress to focus on a trial instead of creating legislation to cope with a raging pandemic and a once-in-a-century economic disaster. Many fear the controversial trial will eliminate willingness for bipartisanship in a Congress in which Democrats have only a very slim margin of control. That's a different agenda than Franklin Delano Roosevelt's first 100 days in 1933, when he rolled out 15 major pieces of legislation, which began the so-called New Deal and economic recovery. The trial will begin on February 8th and must dominate the proceedings of Congress until its conclusion weeks later. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
They are clearly very different issues, but EU foreign affairs ministers have agreed the two main policy areas on which they want to make progress with the United States are climate change and the Iran nuclear deal, officially known as the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The ministers have just concluded face-to-face talks on the subjects in Brussels.
From climate change to Iran and JCPOA, and the most important ones, the most urgent ones, and the ministers are ready for a new start.
That new start is necessary because of Donald Trump's hate-fueled anti-Iran campaign during the past 4 years. The former U.S. president pulled Washington out of the nuclear deal in 2018 and imposed unilateral sanctions designed to try and cripple Iran's economy. Firms across the European Union have made it clear they very much want to do business with the Islamic Republic. Economists say U.S. banking-related sanctions against Tehran are stifling that business. There is now some optimism that change is coming because Joe Biden has indicated the U.S. will rejoin the nuclear accord, which was signed by Iran and six world powers in 2015 and underpinned by the United Nations. With the possibility that U.S. sanctions against Tehran will be lifted, EU businesses should prepare to start trading, experts suggest.
I think it probably makes sense to move now and to be one of the early players in the right framework, of course.
With a population greater than 80 million people, Iran represents a big opportunity for EU firms, it has been pointed out. The 27-country bloc, which is heavily dependent on energy imports, could also address fuel security issues.
Iran would have its energy fields, its gas and oil, which are huge, some of the biggest in the world, opened again to markets, in particular the European market, which would be, you know, a beneficiary of this.
Tehran says Washington can only rejoin the JCPOA if there are no preconditions. Since entering the White House last week, Joe Biden has already spoken with Boris Johnson and Emmanuel Macron about the nuclear deal. The big unknown right now is, will Biden be willing or able to stand up to those who want to see the agreement completely disintegrate? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Turkey and Greece held their first direct talk in 5 years over tensions which grew between the two neighboring countries over the past years. Turkey has been at loggerheads with Greece and Cyprus over an energy-rich area in the Mediterranean Sea. Tensions flared up last year after Ankara deployed an exploration vessel to the contested waters. The move foundered plans for the resumption of Athens-Ankara negotiations that had been stalled since 2016. The two sides were still trading barbs in the days leading up to the meetings. Last week, Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis said his country will attend those talks with optimism, but, quote, zero naivety. Issues that are on the agenda of the delegations are bilateral disputes, maritime boundaries, and drilling rights.
In talks with Greece, we hope that the issues will be dealt with within the framework of rights, law, and equity, and that solutions are found. We hope that Greece respects our rights in the Aegean and Eastern Mediterranean and avoids actions that may cause misunderstandings.
The meetings were held with international optimism as well, especially from the EU. Analysts say this whole meeting was due to the bloc's pressure on both sides and voiced concerns over the delegations failing to reach an agreement.
The two sides met to agree on several points. Greece wants to discuss East Mediterranean and Turkey wants to discuss arming Aegean islands. Therefore, they will need more time to reach a common ground, and I think it's hard for both sides to reach an agreement, just like it was in the previous talks. I think the talks are being held mainly due to the EU pressure.
This is the 61st negotiations between the two, as talks were initiated in March 2002 and stopped in 2016 without reaching an agreement. Hopes seem high about the outcome of the talks, but given previous experiences, observers say the disputes between Turkey and Greece need more than this to be resolved. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Axel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayd Al-Salami. We're talking about how we are able to deal with ourselves and the importance of making sure that we take care of our body, our spirit, our soul. And of course, just reminding you that we're on part one of the book, which is how to deal with yourself. And of course, then we go on to, inshallah, later on into part two, how you deal with others, how to deal with others. From Imam Sadiq salamullahi alayhi, where he says, وَإِيَّاكَ وَشُرْبَ الْمَاءِ الْبَارِدِ. Stay away from drinking cold, water. A lot of these other hadith that Sheikh Jawadi Amuli is mentioning, here he says, you know, when you have finished from your hammam, when you're finished from having a shower, make sure that you pour cold water on your feet. You know, all of these things, you know, we're able to talk about as far as the healthy side of what they do. You know, we know that, for example, drinking cold water isn't good. And finishing off a shower with cold water is something good. And here, again, he says, قَالَ بَعْضُهُمْ خَرَجَ الصَّادِقَ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ مِنَ الْحَمَّامِ فَلَبِسَ وَتَعَمَّمَ. That Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam exited the bathroom, the shower, and he put on his clothes and he wore a turban. He covered his head. قال فما تركت العمامة عند خروجي من الحمام في الشتاء والصيف. That never has it been that I've had a shower, that I've left the bath without covering my head, whether it be in winter or whether it be in summer. Of course, again, that's another very good thing for us to do to avoid any kind of sicknesses, not to get, you know, hit by a cold breeze or something like that. You know, from you to leave, you know, cold or hotness, and then suddenly be hit by a fan or by a cold breeze or something like that, of course you're going to get sick. You know, these are all, you know, beautiful examples of how we are able to understand the details of what A'immatu Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam speak about. Continuing on, you know, we always need to remember that when we are doing some of these things, you know, we remember that we have the dua element also involved in this, like this. Dua, Allahumma albisni taqwa wa jannibni ar-rada. Oh Allah, dress me with the clothes of taqwa and keep me away from any kind of rada, radi, vile, bad, vice, any kind of evil or wretchedness. And when do you do this? When you, for example, putting on your clothes after you've cleaned yourself, after you've finished your hammam, your shower, and you are now putting on your clothes. This is the kind of, you know, beautiful way of remembering that anything that we do, we're relating it, we're connecting it with our religion as well, and our connection and relationship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I'd just like to make another important point, which Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli also mentions here, you know, where there are those connections that we always need to remember. That yes, you know, this hadith does say, for example, وَإِيَّاكَ وَشُرْبُ الْمَاءِ الْبَارِدِ. But maybe sometimes in certain areas, in certain times, in certain places, drinking cold water is in reality something good for you. Or the hadith says that, for example, وَتَرْكُ الْعَشَاءِ مَهْرَمَةٌ. That leaving dinner is something that will bring about haram, something that will bring about oldness. But when you do get old, you need to always remember that you have a full stomach, dinner time.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree,
امام اونطوری که اینو گفته بودم گفته دی اون امامش گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
وَإِذَا سَنَّاءَ لَا يَبِيتَ That you shouldn't have gone to sleep at night time unless you have a full stomach. But here, Sheikh Jawadi Amuli is saying that this is an example of where we need to compare these ahadith with other ahadith, where we need to look at these ahadith, but also look at the opinion of a specialist for certain occasions, for certain individuals, for certain circumstances. So this is also where we need to look at case studies as well. And if an expert was to say that, yes, we know that this is what the hadith say, we know that they're authentic, but in your case, it's not applicable. And that's why we do have a hadith that speak on this side, we do have a hadith that also speak on the other side as well. Does that mean that there's a contradiction here in the expression of what these traditions are saying? The answer is no. What they are saying is giving us general guidelines, but the application here is going to be circumstantial depending on certain scenarios. But, you know, we understand that there are always going to be things that are bad for us in general. So we are able to have some kind of universal, you know, agreement on certain things. Imam Ar-Ridha, for example, Salamullahi alayhi, he says one of the things that do bring about sicknesses is a person retaining their urine, which means they're kind of like restricting themselves. And habsul bawl, as it says, that you are not going to the toilet when you need to. You're getting to yourself to such a desperate kind of situation where, you know, you're, as we say, you're busting to go to the toilet. You don't need to get yourself to that particular situation. And that, of course, is something wrong and negative. Now, continuing on with these kind of discussions, we're going to speak about the other kind of physical elements that bring about, physical factors that bring about sicknesses. And then we will talk about the spiritual factors. But when we mention things like judam, when we mention things like, you know, what is going to bring about goodness in a person's life, you know, for example, there's the hadith that says that don't stay long in the toilet, don't prolong your seating in the toilet, because if you were to do so, it will bring about hemorrhoids, for example. So that's why it's makruh to prolong your seating in the toilets. وطول الجلوس على الخلاء يورث الباسور. That prolonging your seating in بيت الخلاء, which means basically the toilet, يورث الباسور, that it brings about hemorrhoids, which is of course something that is always going to be avoided. Inshallah, we will continue on in our next episode. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. The leadership of the Proud Boys has come under increased scrutiny as agents and prosecutors across the United States try to determine how closely members of the far-right nationalist group communicated during the riot at the Capitol this month, and to what extent they might have planned the assault in advance, according to federal law enforcement officials. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Alan Feuer and Francis Robles. The piece is titled Proud Boys Under Growing Scrutiny in Capitol Riot Investigation. Stay with us for more of Alan Feuer and Francis Robles' article. The leadership of the Proud Boys has come under increased scrutiny as agents and prosecutors across the United States try to determine how closely members of the far-right nationalist group communicated during the riot at the Capitol this month, and to what extent they might have planned the assault in advance, according to federal law enforcement officials. At least six members of the organization have been charged in connection with the riot, including one of its top-ranking leaders, Joseph Biggs. Mr. Biggs, a U.S. Army veteran, led about 100 men on an angry march from the site of President Donald J. Trump's speech towards and then into the Capitol building. The Proud Boys, who have a history of scuffling with left-wing anti-fascist activists, have long been some of Donald Trump's most vocal and violent supporters, and he has returned the favor, telling them during one of the presidential debates to stand back and stand by. along with the right-wing militia, the Oath Keepers. The Proud Boys was one of the extreme groups with a large presence at the Capitol incursion, investigators said. Despite having launched one of the most sprawling inquiries in American history, investigators have yet to unearth clear-cut evidence suggesting there was a widespread conspiracy to assault the Capitol building on Wednesday, 6th of January. Still in recent days, they have turned their attention towards a pair of Proud Boy organizers on the West Coast and have started executing a series of search warrants connected to the group, a federal law enforcement official said, speaking on the condition of anonymity because he was not authorized to discuss an ongoing inquiry. One of the organizers of Proud Boys, Ethan Nordine of Auburn, Washington State, appeared with Mr. Biggs in a YouTube video on the day Donald Trump's rally and can be seen shouting orders to a group of Proud Boys through a bullhorn. Ethan Nordine, also known as Rufio Panman, investigators said, is named in Mr. Biggs's criminal complaint but has not been charged himself. The second Proud Boy organizer, Eddie Block of Madera, California, took video of Mr. Biggs and Mr. Nordine during the event in Washington, according to a photograph included in Mr. Biggs's charging documents. In an hour-long YouTube video that he live-streamed this weekend, Mr. Block acknowledged that about 25 federal agents swooped down on his house on Friday, seizing two of his cell phones, a laptop, an iPad, an Xbox, and an old computer. When reached by phone on Tuesday, 26th of January, Mr. Block declined to comment further on the federal investigation. Mr. Nordine could not be reached for comment. The FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, has acknowledged that it is conducting a similarly serious inquiry into the Oath Keepers. Oath Keepers are a group of largely composed of law enforcement and military personnel, and also the Three Percenters, which emerged from the extremist wing of the gun rights movement. Several members of both organizations have already been charged in connection with a Capitol attack, including three defendants who stand accused of the most severe conspiracy allegations leveled so far. FBI investigators involved in the Capitol attack have also focused their attention on the chairman of the Proud Boys, Enrique Tarrio. Mr. Tarrio, who lives in Miami, Florida, was scheduled to attend the march in Washington, but was thrown out of the city by a judge the day before it happened. When he was arrested on 4th of January in connection with the burning of a Black Lives Matter banner that had been torn from a historic black church during a different round of violent protests last month, police officers found he was carrying two high-capacity rifle magazines emblazoned with the Proud Boys chicken logo. Prosecutors have noted in documents attached to Mr. Biggs's case that Mr. Tarrio first began encouraging the Proud Boys to go to Washington for the Stop the Steal march in late December, when he posted a message on the social media app Parler announcing that members of the group would turn out in record numbers. In the run-up to the rally, Mr. Tarrio also used Parler to urge his members to avoid wearing their traditional black and yellow polo shirts, but instead to go incognito and move about the city in smaller teams, prosecutors say. In an interview with the New York Times 1 week after the siege, Enrique Tarrio, who took over the Proud Boys from its founder, Gavin McInnes, said that the attack on the Capitol was misguided and that anyone who broke windows or took part in the nearly 140 assaults on police officers should be prosecuted. He tried to minimize the role that the Proud Boys played in the attack on the Capitol building, even though among the 150 people charged so far, prosecutors have brought charges against Nicholas Oakes, the leader of the group's Hawaii chapter, and Nicholas DiCarlo, one of the top media figures. Dominic Pozzola, a Proud Boy from Rochester, New York, was in the first wave of rioters to breach the Capitol, prosecutors say, and stands accused of shattering a window with a plastic police riot shield. Obviously, they didn't help our cause, Enrique Tarrio said. Investigators are continuing to sift through online posts and messages by Enrique Tarrio and by Mr. Biggs in an effort to determine if they showed any attempt at coordination or planning of the attack on the Capitol building, according to federal law enforcement officials. On the day of the attack, Enrique Tarrio took to Parler, calling members of the Proud Boys who took part in its revolutionaries and urged them not to leave. "For now, I'm enjoying the show," he wrote, adding, "Do what must be done." While investigators are increasingly focused on people who may have pre-planned the attack, any evidence that the assault on the Capitol building was organized in advance could be a factor in Donald Trump's second impeachment trial, scheduled for early February in the U.S. Senate. House Democrats have accused the former president of inciting the riot, which led to the deaths of five people, including one Capitol police officer. Several defendants have said they joined the siege following Donald Trump's orders. But if proof emerges that groups like the Proud Boys or the Oath Keepers plotted in it in the days before it happened, it could undermine some arguments that Donald Trump is entirely to blame. On the other hand, evidence could end up showing that any pre-planned attack was inspired by weeks of the former president's insistence that the election was rigged.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
The first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam.
By Hujjatul Islam, Zayd As-Salam.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Was salatu was salamu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi at-tahirin. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to IRIB English Radio and another program of For Humanity, where we are discussing Imam Ali al-Sajjad's Risalatul Huquq, the Treaties of Rights. And at the moment we're talking about the rights of the person who has a claim against someone, or for a person who wants to make a claim against someone. And this in the Arabic language is called al-mudda'i wal-mudda'i alayh. And we can use the word that we have been using so far in English is the adversary. Now, we did mention that Imam Ali Sajjad's approach here is not that of a legal approach, that if you're in a court situation and what you need to do and things like that. Even though we spoke in detail about how important it is for arbitration and how an arbitrator or a judge, a qadi, needs to be valued in their position that they have and what kind of qualities they need if they were to take this position of wanting to reconcile and bring about a level of understanding between two conflicting parties. That's very, very important as well, because, you know, as Muslims, we don't want to create any kind of disturbance in a community. We want to keep everyone in harmony and avoid any kind of conflict. And this is why, in the personal dimension, everyone needs to have a level of responsibility and they need to be well informed that they do not exceed the limits and the boundaries of their rights. And when there is a dispute, they know what to do and how to deal with the disputes. This is something that has been taught to us as Muslims by the Quran and also by the narrations from Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them. And so the particular approach here is that when there is a dispute between two adversaries, then justice needs to prevail. If there is something, Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, in the beginning of this segment, he says, if there is something being said that is true and against you, then you also need to support that. You don't reject it. You don't deny it. No, you receive it. You support it. You acknowledge it. And you be fair. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he always taught the Muslims how to surrender and how to stop as far as rights are concerned if the right is with the other person. And in these legal rights, in these religious rights, in these social rights, never, never, never exceed your limits. Again, the purpose here is all to educate people to become fair, to become just, to become equal in their conduct, in how they are interacting with other people. We're just going to go for a short break and we will be back very soon.
Sallallahu ala Muhammad, sallallahu ala Nabi, sallallahu ala Muhammad wa ala ali Nabi.
Welcome back, dear listeners, and accordingly, based on these things that we are hearing from Imam As-Sajjad, peace be upon him, where he says, وَأَمَّا حَقُّ الْخَصْمِ الْمُدَّعِي عَلَيْكَ, as for the rights of the adversary that has a claim against you, if they were truthful in that, in what it is that they are claiming against you, then you need to make sure that you receive it, you welcome it, and that you don't reject it or deny it. And furthermore, that you are making the claim against yourself as well. وَكُنْتَ خَصْمَ نَفْسِكَ لَهُ. So you support them in standing against your own self. This is, of course, a high level of integrity, a high level of truthfulness, a high level of honesty that one needs to have. You need to be a very, very selfless person for you to have such kind of conduct. And that's exactly what our imams want from us. You want to execute the highest level of justice, you need to do so against yourself if the other party is truthful. And so in this case, that if that there is someone who wants to claim against you and they are truthful, then you need to make sure that you also support this true claim. Now, this is exactly why Imam As-Sajjad, he then says, "In you should be your own adversary in their favor." وَكُنْتَ خَصْمَ نَفْسِكَ لَهُ. And then Imam As-Sajjad, peace be upon him, he says, "وَالْحَاكِمْ عَلَيْهَا." And you be the judge against your own self. You also be the witness for the claim as well. وَشَاهِدَ لَهُ بِحَقِّهِ. Right? You are the judge against yourself, and you are the witness for their claim without them having to need any other kind of witnesses. That's why he says, دُونَ شَهَادَةِ الشُّهُودِ, without the witnessing of any other witnesses. Now, this is a beautiful stage that one is able to reach if they were honest to themselves. And that's exactly why Imam Sajjad says, if there is a time where there is a conflict, fairness must be demanded. You need to make sure that your soul is so pure enough that you will never accept falsehood. You will never testify to a false statement. And you will always sentence yourself against yourself before you sentence anyone else in a court, or else that's going to be dhulm. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, and inna al-qubha fi al-dhulmi bi qadar al-husna fi al-adl, that the wickedness or the evilness in oppression is the same level as goodness in fairness and justice. So in the likes of these kind of traditions where Imam alayhi salam is saying that this is not the right that one needs to be looked at as far as it only being the right of justice, but also the right of staying away from dhulm, and that this right is not to be formed from the very beginning of the disputes and if a misunderstanding arises. Why? Because a fair person, a just person who sees the opposing party having a claim against them, and that them being right, you should not avoid their kind of claim. We're going to continue on speaking about this segment in the rights, the treaties of rights by Imam As-Sajjad in our next episode on Here for Humanity. And until then, please visit us on www.parstoday.com, or you're able to email us on englishradio@irib.ir. Until our next program, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli wa sallim ala rasuli wa ali nabiyil azim. Allahumma salli wa sallim ala rasuli wa ali nabiyil azim.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.